It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Did you know you can learn exercises to train your brain to communicate better with your body? You can discover your own self-healing potential at the only East Coast workshop to be given this year by the internationally known pioneer therapist, Dr. Mayer Schneider. If you are tired of wearing glasses or if you have achy joints or muscles, I encourage you to sign up now and learn these techniques to create profound change. Reduce tension, relieve pain, improve vision, and preventive degenerative conditions. The Mayer Schneider Self-Healing Method is coming to the Ruska Mansion June 15th through the 19th. Call 410-340-5551 for more information or online at self-healing.org. Call 410-340-5551. Movement for self-healing and natural vision improvement.
Oh, give us a flag, oh, free without a slave. We'll fight to defend it, as our fathers did so brave. Gallant Company A, we'll make those rebels dance. We'll stand by the Union, we only get our chance.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus this evening, friends. Our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner, and our engineer this evening is, Chris Klaproff. I hope I pronounced that correctly. This is their first night on 21st Century Radio. And this Wednesday is Flag Day, and every one of you listening is invited to celebrate it with us and hundreds of other Marylanders at Fort McHenry. When we pause for the pledge, I'll have my new art car there called Founding Fathers, and we'll be doing my best to explain the 7 different American flags I painted all along the passenger side. See flagday.org for more information. I have always been fascinated with the history and evolving symbolism of our nation's flag, and longtime listeners know I have done several shows on it over the years. But it was not until quite recently that I came across an interesting twist on the history or historical story of our flag. Someone I respected referred me to a web page where I read an article that claimed that the flag we are familiar with, the red and white horizontal stripes with a blue canton and white stars, was actually our military flag. Flying it instead of the civil flag for peacetime implied our country was still under martial law. That's what they stated. Now, this article goes on to claim that there used to be quite a different flag in use called the civil flag to distinguish the two. According to the author of this article, the civil flag was to be flown in peacetime and over all non-governmental institutions. It had red and white stripes in a vertical pattern and a white canton with blue stars. For various nefarious reasons, it was explained that the Civil War was never officially declared over, and therefore we are still flying our military flag at all times, the civil flag having fallen into the category of forgotten history. Well, this sounded most interesting to me, so I started to do a little web research on it. Well, you got to be careful on the web, I guess you guys know that. And what I found was the same article repeated verbatim at a number of different conspiracy/patriot websites, but none of them listed the author of the piece or gave many references to back up the claims. Now, this lack of primary evidence concerned me, so we sought out an expert on flags known as a vexillologist, and have invited him on the air for this first half hour to explain this seemingly erroneous tale. His name is Dave Martucci, and he is the past president of the North American Vexillological Association, editor of several flag journals, a professional antique U.S. flag appraiser, and the designer of more than 100 flags. He has a terrific website just loaded with fascinating facts about our flag and flags in general called Vexman, VEXMAN.net, which you can find under the name Dave Martucci, I'll spell that for you, MARTUCCI, on the top right corner of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Dave.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're so glad you made it as well, because this piece of information concerning a so-called civil flag certainly knocked me off my chair. I never had even thought that this kind of thing existed until, several months ago. Now, you said in one of your emails to me that the real story of the American flag and how our ancestors viewed it is much more interesting than what you called this crackpot theory, end of quote, or a civil versus a military flag.
That's right.
Now, that may be true, but since our time with you is limited on the air tonight, I'd like you first to spell this theory out for us as far as what is claimed and why, and then how you are able to deconstruct those claims.
Well, if you read the articles that you mentioned, sooner or later they all refer back to a passage in Nathaniel Hawthorne's book, The Scarlet Letter, which was published in 1850. And in the first chapter of that book, he describes that he works in a building that displays the banner of the Republic, but with the 13 stripes turned vertically instead of horizontally, thus indicating that a civil and not a military post of the government is operating in that building. And in fact, if you know anything about the history of Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know that besides being a writer, his job, his real job, the one that paid him money, was being a civil servant, and he worked for the Customs Department. And the Customs flag, which was adopted in 1799, in fact, indeed, has 16 vertical red and white stripes and a white field on which is supposed to be an eagle and 13 blue stars. And so that's the flag he was describing, and this has somehow been taken out of context and converted into something that never existed.
Well, is it erroneous to state that the original version of the Coast Guard or the Revenue Cutter Service devised by Alexander Hamilton to quash smuggling was a civilian authority?
Well, that would be incorrect. It was an authority that was established by the government of the United States, particularly under the Executive Department of the President, and they were charged with the job of making sure that the customs laws were enforced and that people weren't smuggling goods in and out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so to call it a civil authority, that's stretching it in terms of what we understand a civil authority to be today.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly at the time, it was considered a governmental flag. No question about that.
Well, is there such a thing as the quote, law of the flag, as quoted in these web accounts of the civil flag, whereby they state that by the law of the flag, this design denoted civil jurisdiction under the Constitution and common law, as opposed to military jurisdiction under admiralty or military law.
You know, I saw that some time ago, and I spent some serious time trying to find out what the heck did they mean by the law of the flag. And when you finally unearth that bit of information on the web, it's a lot of information that sort of is redundant. It refers back to itself in many places, and it never really quotes any kind of authority.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of the law of the flag before. There are international protocols about flags, but none of that had anything to do with any of those.
Well, how do you answer the statement that the quote, the practice of using the customs flag as a civil flag became encoded in law in 1874, when Treasury Secretary William A. Richardson required all custom houses to display the civil flag?
Well, that's simple. It was customary but not required for custom houses to display that flag prior to that date. And the authority was put forth at that point that it had to be flown from every customs house. And in fact, the custom houses still fly that same flag today. So one of the principal discussion points is that that flag has somehow vanished, and in fact it has not vanished.
Well, I understand there was very little written about flags in the 18th century.
And that's true.
And we have to remember that they were tools or signals then and did not stir the souls like they do today.
The usage of flags has evolved over the years, and in fact the term national flag originated with the American flag. There was no national flag before the Stars and Stripes was thought up. And it wasn't for many, many years after the adoption of the Stars and Stripes that that term actually really became to be understood as a flag that represented a nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think the distinction of the vertical and horizontal stripes was simply a visual distinction that made it easy to determine a U.S. Navy vessel from a revenue cutter?
I think that that had a lot to do with it. It wasn't until 1818 that the U.S. flag was specified to have horizontal stripes. Prior to that, the two resolutions of Congress simply said there would be a certain number of stripes. They never said whether they would be horizontal or vertical. And in fact, we do know that in the early days, there were some that displayed stripes vertically. Mm-hmm. I think that that was just not anything anybody was terribly concerned about.
Well, I greatly appreciate your checking this out for us, because the web can really be a friend and it can really be a nuisance at times, especially when there are no references to what they're talking about.
And that's right.
And you can waste so much time, and there's so much hype about certain types of conspiracies today that many times just confuse the issue, because as I found in the study of the National Coat of Arms of the United States, that most people absolutely refuse to go to primary sources. And that's where I think much of the problem lies, especially for instance, the Great Seal of the United States.
That's right.
Because here's the greatest bone of contention is that the first committee that designed the Great Seal, all of them were Freemasons. Well, none of them were.
That's right.
None of them that designed the Great Seal of the United States were Freemasons. But the kind of power this has had over so many minds and that are active in conspiracy thinking is just amazing. It's just too bad they didn't read history, that's all.
That's right. And indeed, some of the Masonic symbols were adopted after the American Revolution, patterned on Revolutionary-era symbols.
Correct. And, of course, as you know, many of the Masonic symbols were pre-revolutionary. They were Renaissance.
That's right.
And that's where the genius of our founding fathers' inspiration, much of it came from. These were very learned men. These were brilliant men.
That's right.
Now let's talk about the real story of the American flag and how our ancestors viewed it. What are some of the concepts that Americans pioneered regarding flags?
Well, in the 1770s, there was no such thing as a national flag. Flags belonged to governments, they belonged to armies, most importantly, they belonged to kings and princes and potentates. And what we did was we established the Continental Congress as the expression of the people of this country. And it was the Continental Congress in 1777, on June 14th, who decided that the flag that they would put forth had the 13 stripes and the 13 stars. The stars, by the way, representing a new constellation. And it wasn't for another 20 years or so before people began to realize that this was something really unique, really different, and that the flag was, by that point, being used by everybody in the country. It wasn't just something that you had to have permission from the authority to use. And because we have never changed the basic design, the last resolution of Congress regarding the flag was in 1818, and all that said was 13 red and white stripes, horizontal, blue field, star for each state, and we add a star on the 4th of July following the mission of a state. Well, that all speaks to the people owning that flag. The government has never made a claim on the flag. They never restricted use of the flag. And you can see throughout the 19th and 20th centuries that people took that flag to heart. They used it in all kinds of strange combinations, wonderful combinations, and an expression of patriotic fervor. And to this day, the people in this country, unlike almost every other nation, feel the ownership of that flag. The flag mm-hmm. belongs to us. It doesn't belong to the government. It doesn't belong to a party. I dare say that even if a constitutional amendment to restrict the use of the flag passed, I would say that most people in this country would probably not pay much attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you tell us about one of my most favorite people on the planet, Francis Hopkinson?
Well, Hopkinson was a very educated man. He was a member of the Continental Congress, representative from New Jersey. Hopkinson was a unique person in some ways in that he had artistic abilities. Besides being a statesman and an author, he was a composer of music and he was a painter. And it was his idea that the Congress should adopt a flag. And it was probably his idea for the design. In fact, he was the only person who ever said during their own life that he had, in fact, designed the flag. And although his particular request for a quarter cask of the public wine as payment was never fulfilled, no one ever disputed the fact, you know, that he designed the flag.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he wasn't paid for it, was he?
He was not paid for it.
No, it seems...
But they clearly said at the time... He was a member of Congress. He was already receiving pay. Why should we pay him again?
Yeah, I'm sure he was making millions.
I doubt that.
I'm sorry.
Although he did not die a poor man.
No, not like many of our founding fathers.
That's right.
I have also a great fondness for flags that include a blue stripe along with a red and white one. As I'm sitting in my studio here, I purchased what was called, well, what was referred to as a so-called Benjamin Franklin flag. Red, white, and blue stripes with 8 pointed stars, 13 of them.
Well, you picked up on 2 early design variants that were very significant, actually. The connection with Benjamin Franklin is interesting. When he was the ambassador to France, he received a communication from the ambassador of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, who asked him what the flag looked like, and he described it as having red, white, and blue stripes. And, in fact, many of the early flags probably had some variation, including blue stripes. We know of a number of documents that describe these that way. John Paul Jones, who was a famous naval officer in the Revolution, he preferred to have his flagship fly a flag that included blue stripes and all the other flags having just red and white so that his ship would be easy to determine in the flotilla.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the number of points on the star goes, that was never really specified. Even to this day, there's nothing in the law that says the stars have to have 5 points.
Mm-hmm.
The drawings that the president puts forth show them that way. But the actual written descriptions of the law that establish the flag doesn't mention the number of points on the star at all. And we know of examples of anywhere from 4 to 11 points on stars on various flags. In fact, there are some early flags that have, you know, different numbers of points on each star on the flag.
This is fascinating. I really
think
it's so fascinating. Now, another one of my favorites is the so-called peace flag, one with 48 stars. Why is it called the peace flag? I think it's also called the Whipple flag, but I'm not certain.
Well, the man that designed it, who's William Whipple, he was an educator and a writer. And he wrote a book, I'm trying to think of when it was published. I think it was published somewhere around the turn of the 20th century. I don't remember exactly when. In it, as you probably know from history, that was a period of time of a lot of agitation. It was a period just before the First World War. There was a lot of military things going on in the world. And his idea was to create a flag that spoke of peace and not of war. He was afraid that nationalism was devolving into a military concept. And in his book, he proposed to change the pattern of the stars from rows, which originated in the Navy and the Army, which is very true. And he wanted to have the Great Star from the Great Seal, which is a 6-pointed star made out of 13 smaller stars, and then a ring of 25 stars around that, and then the corresponding number of stars needed to bring it up to 48, which I think was 8 more, surrounding that. And the whole idea was to have something that looked different than what the Army and the Navy used to signify a movement for peace.
Well, it's a beautiful flag.
It
really is.
There were other suggestions. In the 1880s and 1890s, it was very popular to take any national flag and put a white border around it and call it the flag of peace.
Oh, yes. Thank you for mentioning that.
That's right.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. I wish we had another 30 minutes because you've designed some really interesting flags of Middle Earth. And, you know, that's...
They were in the 70s. Information from Tolkien's book.
Yeah, well, we've done many, many shows on Tolkien. And it was really a thrill to be able to see back there. You did these in the 70s, right?
That's right.
Yeah, in the 70s. We had great fear sometime in the 80s with all of the ignorance that was being displayed all over the place in regards to Tolkien, that he was going to die out.
Yeah.
And that's why we ended up doing like 20 or so shows to try to reintroduce him. I want to thank you for joining us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
I always get this wrong. Vexillologist.
Vexillologist.
Oh, almost. I got a B- on that one. And it was... Also, in pointing out, we got to do some more shows dealing with the alleged civil flag because people have been asking us about it. But I'm telling you, it can really waste some time in speculating in areas when there's so much more interesting stuff out there.
I agree with you totally, Bob.
And again, your website is Vexman, VexMan.net, which you can find by clicking his name, and that's Dave Martucci. Clicking his name in the top right corner of 21st Century Radio. We'll be back with Eric Vorboril, yes, the director and programs and collections for Flag House and Star Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore. Friends, the time has come. It's time for you to come out to Barnes & Noble in Pikesville to hear a presentation of my new book, Founding Fathers, Secret Societies. Let's show those crowds in Washington, D.C. and Charlottesville, Virginia, that the folks in Baltimore are just as interested in this timely topic. Just what is the true meaning of the eye in the triangle over the pyramid on the $1 bill? Did Freemasons and Native Americans really influence our Founding Fathers? And do secret societies lurk in the background of today's politics? Come meet me for a book signing and brief presentation at the Barnes & Noble at the Woodholm Center in Pikesville, June the 15th. That's a Thursday from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Note that new time, friends, 7:30 to 8:30. Autographed copies for sale just in time for Father's Day. Makes a super gift for any Masons in your life. Call 410-415-5758 for directions. Hope to see you all on June the 15th from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Woodholm Center in Pikesville, Barnes & Noble.
I'm Joe Sobrin, author of Alias Shakespeare. And you're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
Oh, yes. Brother Neil Young. Extraordinary soul. Brilliant mind. Brilliant musician. And yes, only 30% of Americans now support our president. Interesting, huh? Well, our next guest is from the Flag House and Star-Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore. This is the actual house where Mary Young Pickersgill sewed the enormous, really enormous, 30 by 42 feet flag that was flown over Fort McHenry during the Battle of 1812, which inspired Francis Scott Key to write the Star-Spangled Banner. And founded in 1927, the Flag House and Star-Spangled Banner is one of Baltimore's oldest museums, and Mary Pickersgill's flag still survives and now hangs at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. Oh, before we introduce you to Eric Vorboril, we saw many of our listeners at the Columbia Arts Festival yesterday, and thank you, judges of the Art Car Parade, for awarding our Founding Fathers a prize. That certainly was appreciated. Eric Vorboril is the Director of Programs and Collections for the Flag House and Star Spangled Banner Museum. He is joining us for the next half hour to tell us about the special summer programs planned for the Flag House Museum that are ideal for your out-of-town visitors this summer or children of all ages. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm about an A-plus tonight.
Great, me too.
Yeah, you're out there partying and having a good time, aren't you, Eric?
Yeah, well, you know, got a little mountain biking today, so enjoying this is awesome weather right now we're having. The usual sort of muggy Baltimore summer, so.
What, are you going to try to live to 142 years old?
I
hope so. You might be able to do it, Eric, if you keep staying on that bike. Now, what can visitors to the Flag House and Star-Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore expect to see on their first visit?
On their first visit to the museum?
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, the heart of every visit to the Flag House is a tour of the Flag House itself. And we have a wonderful corps of guides that can share the story of Mary Pickersgill inside the house. And get a chance to see objects that are from the time, and really get a feel for often we visit historic homes around the country, and we get a chance to see our great leaders and things like that. But this is a chance to see how ordinary people here in Baltimore, the people that really built the city and built our country, how they lived in an ordinary house at that time, and in this case, made an extraordinary flag. And how Mary lived with her family. And so they get a chance to learn not just about Mary and her story, but how people lived 200 years ago in Baltimore. And they can also look forward to seeing in our museum, we have a brand new exhibit that just went up a couple weeks ago that shares a lot of our military artifacts from the time when the British were blockading the Chesapeake Bay during the War of 1812. And we were fighting the British. A lot of people don't know that we had a foreign power that was right here, off the shore of our city. And it's a chance to see some really amazing artifacts that we have there, a number of military artifacts, but also things from some ordinary people, and just a chance to glimpse that time when, people had really, had something to fear with naval ships right there, right there off their coasts, and, had to worry probably in a way that, I don't think we can imagine experiencing.
No, I don't think we can. I think you're right. I don't think so, Eric. That must have been an extraordinary experience to realize that, close to 40 years later, that we might lose it all right away. And I'm sure we couldn't sit around and watch our color TVs to tell us what was going to happen tomorrow,
sure.
or be told what we had to know, so
exactly.
to speak. Yeah. Now, the Flag House also gives you a chance to interact with living history. What kind of period costume characters do you have there to answer questions?
Well, of course, you can have a chance to meet Mary Pickersgill herself. She's there working hard at completing the flag. And we try and give people a glimpse of the summer of 1813 when the flag was being made and what was going on in Baltimore then. They can also get a chance to meet Caroline Pickersgill. And we know for a fact that unfortunately we have few documents about the experience of making the flag, but Caroline herself wrote that she helped her mother make the flag. And so, I have a chance to also meet Caroline Pickersgill. One more interesting character, there's sort of an anonymous figure that we don't know much about, but we know that the family rented out the house to boarders. So in this case, folks will have a chance to meet a tutor who is working with Caroline to teach her. At that time, people didn't always have the opportunity to go to school, but often they would hire tutors. And so we sort of imaginatively wondered if Caroline might have had a tutor, because Mary seems to have been somebody who was doing relatively well for herself with her business, and so she may have been able to hire a tutor to teach her daughter a few things like reading and writing, even in the midst of making the flag.
Well, we're going to find out more about Mary Young Pickersgill, especially in regards to female self-sufficiency, which is very important, when we return with our guest, Eric Voberil, the Director of Programs and Collections for the Flag House and Star-Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore. Just imagine being able to hang around with that kind of history. It's extraordinary to me. Flaghouse.org, phone number 410-837-1793. Zoe is hosting next Sunday night, one week earlier than usual, with a bang-up show about global warming and what each of you can do to save the planet. 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBN. How would you like to win a free 21st Century Radio library of books, magazines, and other interesting doodads? Oh, also including my book, Founding Fathers Secret Societies, published by Destiny Books, 1-800-246-8648. If you can answer this question, you might be able to take home the whole library. We had two guests on, well, I think it was, yes, during hour one of 21st Century Radio last week. Give us the name of one of those two guests during hour one of last week. You can start dialing now. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hello there. This is George Martin, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
America, along with advertising, continued to flourish. 1810, Baltimore, Maryland. Just before the War of 1812. To the blacksmith shop of Harry and Dave Rumpelmeyer came lawyer and songwriter Francis Scott Key.
Who is it, Dave?
It's Francis Scott Key. Again.
Oh, boy.
Hi, Mr. Rumpelmeyer. Remember me? Francis Scott Key?
Oh, yeah. You're the fellow who writes the jingles.
That's right. And I got yours all finished.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest Eric Voberl, the Director of Programs and Collections for the Flag House and Star Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore. Please go to their website, flaghouse.org, phone number 410-837-1793. That was an interesting year, 1793. Eric, Baltimore was one of the most racially mixed towns during the early 1800s with a large population of free blacks as well as slaves. What is the African-American history of the Pickersgill House?
We're learning new things all the time, and one of the things we've discovered a little bit more about are the two African-Americans that we know of in the household around the time. We only have a little bit of information, but we know that, according to the 1810 census, that there was a woman who was a slave in the household, as well as a free African-American apprentice, a girl whose name we actually know now. Her name was Grace Wisher. And she became apprentice, but a contract was signed between her mother, Jenny, and Mary Pickersgill. And so she was in the household to learn sewing and what was called then the mystery of housewifery for that time. And so she was there as part of that household. And you can imagine, since she was there learning sewing, we know that both of those people probably, creating such an enormous flag in one summer, that both of those people probably had a role in making the flag. Even if they didn't necessarily participate in sewing the flag itself, being part of the household, they certainly had a role in helping create that flag. Although you can imagine if she was learning sewing that she probably was. So, we're learning new things, and it's an exciting opportunity to be able to talk about both the slave and the free African-American population in Baltimore. I mean, it was really significant. African-Americans made up almost a quarter of the population of Baltimore that time.
And
it had the largest African-American population for a city in the country at that time. So that's always been an important part of Baltimore's story, and we're excited that we can tell that story, especially being next door to the new Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History.
Wow, what an interesting synchronistic experience that is. So I'm glad Mary had some help. It's a very large flag to do
sure.
by yourself.
Yeah.
40 feet by.
Yeah, seriously.
42 by 30 feet. Is that right? I got that right?
Yeah, 30 by 42 feet.
Yeah, that's a large one, all right.
Two stories high.
Now, what do we learn also about female self-sufficiency from Mary Young Pickersgill?
Well, I think there's a few things that are interesting about her. I mean, I think it really is extraordinary that both she and her mother ran a business, and they were both widows. They both lost their husbands. Mary's father died during the Revolutionary War. Mary's husband actually was English, and he died in London. He was an agent working with merchants, traveling back and forth, and he died in London. So both of these ladies were widows, and yet they maintained a business at a time when, you know, very few women had business onto themselves. I think it's interesting, you know, you think about, on the one hand, it certainly was a challenge for them as widows, but it also probably in some ways was an opportunity, because at those times, keeping a house and rearing children was such an extraordinary job, just the intensity of labor that would go into that, that it really, if a woman did have a family, it probably made it almost, particularly if she was a middle-class person who couldn't afford servants, it probably would have made it almost impossible for a woman to pursue a career as she was doing that. And so actually being widows who chose not to remarry probably opened up the opportunity for them to run their businesses. And so, you know, seizing that opportunity, they were able to pursue a life as flag makers and support their families.
Hmm. Wow, that must have really been tough, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I understand you have a new exhibit on the War of 1812. We touched on a few items a little earlier. And this is in the Chesapeake region, including objects never before displayed. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. We've got an exhibit that explores, first of all, it explains a little bit about the War of 1812, which is always a question for people. You know, it's kind of a complicated war. It's not one, you know, we hear a lot about it. It kind of gets lost between, you know, between the Revolution and the Civil War. So we explain a little bit about the causes. But we also show people a number of objects that were used by, in particular, citizen soldiers. At that time, all men 18 to 45 were expected to serve in the militia. It was a little different from now. You know, you have a little bit more of a choice in the matter at this point. And but at that time, men were expected to muster as part of their state militia. And so these were ordinary guys, sometimes who weren't even properly supplied to go out and fight. And at that time, we didn't have a very big professional army, and so, you know, these ordinary men were expected to go out and defend themselves against British soldiers who had been fighting against Napoleon, you know, in all the fighting that was going on in Europe at that time. So, fighting against seasoned soldiers and sailors, and you know, and expected to defend their homes. Mm. And so, we have a number of the objects that those men, and then also some of the things that women had at the time. We talk a little bit about what the experience was like for women and children here in Baltimore. So some of the kinds of objects that we had, we haven't had on display. We've had in our collection on loan a telescope that was actually used, according to the family, by the Todd family, and it was actually used by Mr. Todd to actually spot the British as they were sailing up the river. They had a home near North Point, and in fact, the Todd's inheritance, the home that's there, they're actually trying to preserve it as a War of 1812 site right now. And he actually used this telescope to spot the British as they were sailing up the river. We also have a drum that was used by a drummer named Henry Leitner, and it was actually at Fort McHenry. This is the actual drum that he had with him, and it's one of the few objects that we have, one of the few intact objects that we had that was actually at Fort McHenry.
Wow!
And it's a beautiful drum. It was hand painted, with the Great Seal on it, with the eagle, with stars on the front of it. So it's you know, we have a number of objects like that are things that, you know, used by ordinary people, you know, facing extraordinary circumstances.
Well, and it's not just looking at some terrifically important objects, but you also have ongoing public events sponsored at the Flag House.
Sure.
Could you tell us about some of those?
Well, of course, this week coming up, we have Flag Day. And if you're in the area, you know, we'd love to have you. Obviously, the Flag Day would be a great place to focus a little bit on the flag. Every year, we've had some gentlemen who form a color guard for their Korean War veterans, and so we'll be raising the flag first thing in the morning, and of course we'll be having tours all day. Also, you know, like I mentioned, we have our living history tours. Later this summer, we're going to be having a program. One of the interesting things that I think is really neat about the Flag House is that it was used by, it was actually, after the Pickersgills left the home, a number of immigrant families used the house. You know, we're right across the street from Little Italy. We're right near, Old Town. Well, we're in the middle of Old Town, which was a thriving Jewish neighborhood in Baltimore. And so different families over the time used the house. And many of them were very aware that the house has this, you know, this important story in our history. And so they took care of the house during their time that was there. And so we're going to be giving a special tour later this summer. We haven't set a date yet, but it's probably going to be in August where people can get a chance to learn about it. So you get to the website, come on down, and you can take a special tour. That tour will also be going to the Carroll Mansion, which is down the street. And the mansion is where Charles Carroll Carrollton, the oldest living signer of the Declaration of Independence, actually died there. He's another famous Marylander who was also in the neighborhood at one point. And so it's a chance to learn about the immigrant families that lived in the neighborhood.
A truly great man, Charles Carroll of Carrollton. Now, you serve a lot of school groups and tours of children, don't you?
Absolutely.
Does this only during the week or ever during the weekends?
Yeah, sometimes we do get young groups on the weekends. We also we do have programs for Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts. You know, they often have a special interest in learning about patriotic stories like this. And we have a number of programs for them. The school groups that come on down can look forward to a chance to really do some hands-on things. You know, we feel like it's important for kids to get a chance to really experience the house almost as historians, you know, to get a chance to see what it's like to, you know, we get the special privilege here working on staff to work with these objects, and so we want to give the students who come here a chance too. So the students here get a chance to work with some of the replica objects that we have here. We have a number of programs where they get a chance to look at clothing, flags. We have a program called a Citizen Soldier where they get a chance to learn about what it was like to, you know, serve in the militia at that time, just the difficulties and challenges with that and the kinds of things that those soldiers carried in the War of 1812.
Boy, I wish I would have experienced that when I was growing back in the old days. I really do.
Yeah, it was those kinds of experiences that got me into the museum business in the first place.
Well, I can understand why. I mean, it's such a joy to be able to be around those type of objects. Which are part of us, period.
No, it's a special thrill, and you know, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to share these things. You know, sometimes I almost get get a little too excited about some of these things. You know, and I, you know, I'm always trying to share more with people, and so we try and do what we can, and you know, we really hope that people can see as much as they can here, and that's why we have our new exhibit. We're really excited about our new museum building because people can see all these things that we haven't had a chance to show up until recently.
Well, the new building, is that going to contain the great flag window?
That's right. You could actually, part of our new museum, we wanted people to get a chance to see how large the flag. You know, of course, the flag itself is at the Smithsonian in Washington, and they're doing a very good job of caring for it there. They've been restoring it, and it's actually going to be a couple of years. On Labor Day, they're going to be closing the Museum of American History to actually build a new exhibit for the flag, and so people will be able to get to see it as they've never seen it before. It's been on display in a conservation lab where you can see it, but there's going to be a new exhibit there. So in the meantime, people can get a chance to see here. The window on the front of the house is the original size of the flag. The flag actually lost some of its original size because the family actually gave pieces of the flag away as gifts to special friends and dignitaries.
I didn't get any.
No.
Did you get a piece?
Well, it's not mine. I guess I get to see it every once in a while. Yeah. We've got a couple pieces here, so you can actually see what the material was like. But we have the window here as part of the museum, so people can actually see the full 30 by 42 feet size of the flag. It's a beautiful window. It's lit up at night, so if you're ever down in Little Italy at night at visiting one of the restaurants. Come over to Pratt Street and look across our garden, and you can see the window off of Pratt Street. Come in during the day sometime, and you can get a closer look.
There's nothing like a monocotti, a couple of beers, and looking at the flag. Wow,
sure.
That's a great time there. Oh, Eric, we're about out of time. Eric Voberl, the director of programs and collections for the Flag House and Star Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore. And boy, they got a lot of programs. You got to go to their website, flaghouse.org. Phone number 410-837-1793. Thank you ever so much for joining us, Brother Eric.
Thank you, Dr. Hieronymus. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciated it more than you did, so take that. And when... I'm sorry. I get carried away at times, friends. A little moon in Aries does it. And when we return next hour, the co-leader of the Fells Point Ghost Tours is telling us about the ghosts of Fort McHenry and Baltimore's Harbor Haunts. True Ghost Stories with Amy Linwander, Schiffler Books, and FellsPointGhost.com.